from WBUR Boston. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, the Supreme Court tackles gay marriage. The president pushes for new gun legislation. North Dakota passes the toughest abortion restrictions in the country. North Korea amps up its threats, and Cyprus reopens its banks. The Supreme Court heard arguments in two major cases, California's Prop 8 and the Defense of Marriage Act. Justice Anthony Kennedy said that DOMA seemed to represent the federal government intruding on traditional state power.
You are at real risk of running in conflict with what has always been thought to be the essence of the state police power, which is to regulate marriage, divorce, custody.
Cyprus banks are open again thanks to an EU bailout after the island nation closed its banks 2 weeks ago to prevent a run on deposits. The European Commission President José Manuel Barroso said Monday that the EU must support the struggling nation.
I call on Cyprus to show responsibility in implementation of the agreements reached. And I call on all member states of the European Union to show solidarity.
North Dakota now has the nation's toughest abortion restrictions despite the pleas of protesters gathered outside the state capitol before Governor Jack Dalrymple signed the bill. This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Robert Costa of National Review, Brian Monroe of CNN Politics, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation, listeners. What's your ruling on the Supreme Court cases this week? Obama's new plea for gun legislation, North Dakota's new abortion restrictions. You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Robert Costa, Washington editor for National Review. Bob Costa, welcome back to On Point.
Oh, it's great to join you.
Also with us from Washington, Brian Monroe, editor of CNNpolitics.com. Brian, welcome back to you as well.
Thanks for having me.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us as always. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Jane, Robert, and Brian.
So an historic week at the Supreme Court, of course. We'll get to specifics. But broadly speaking, give us a sense of how you saw things this week. Bob Costa.
It's really an eventful week for conservatives and Republicans because the national conversation on marriage is changing. And it's not only the Supreme Court case and the deliberations there that's really causing a lot of argumentation on the right and across the country, but Senator Rob Portman from Ohio and other Republicans such as Karl Rove are really looking at the marriage issue differently. And it makes me think as a reporter and editor that when you look at 2014 and 2016, maybe the Republican Party is going to be much more embracing of people who have different views on social issues, specifically regarding marriage.
Brian Monroe, does this a sweeping ruling seem less likely or more likely at the Supreme Court after what you heard this week?
Well, it all depends on which day you listened. The first day of arguments on the Prop 8 case from California was there were some tough questions there, but it was hard to really read the tea leaves, particularly because there were definite issues there that they could split hairs and do a very narrow ruling that only affected California. But the next day, the broader defense of marriage arguments, it was clear that many of the justices were looking for ways of understanding if that Defense of Marriage Act was constitutional. And in fact, the biggest fireworks you saw might have been when Chief Justice Roberts fired off at the U.S. Solicitor General, and really he was attacking President Obama because he did not feel the way the administration had handled. Basically, the administration stepped back and said that they would not defend this in front of the Supreme Court, and he thought that was an abdication of their executive power responsibilities.
That was quite a moment, Jack Beatty, wasn't it, when Chief Justice Roberts suggested the Obama White House was trying to really have it both ways, believing DOMA was unconstitutional but continuing to defend it anyway.
Yes, and the Solicitor General had some problems in other areas as well. It's a difficult dance for them, for the administration. I just want to return to a point that Robert was making. You know, on Sunday last week, Karl Rove was asked, can you imagine Republicans in 2014, 2016 running on, gay marriage, saying yes to gay marriage? And he said he could imagine it. He could think it through. And there was a strong reaction to that. And I wonder what Robert makes of that. I mean, you had Ralph Reed come out and say, listen, 40-odd percent of Mitt Romney's vote was from evangelicals. They don't want gay marriage. Don't betray this electorate. And of course, in the court case, who was it that was defending DOMA? It was the House Republican majority that hired Paul Clement that was defending the law. So hard to square these at least warnings about betraying an electorate, and then the House GOP. Hard to square that with the idea that maybe the GOP can come around on what, in their post-mortem, they called a gateway issue for young people. You've got to get right with it.
Bob Costa, what do you think?
It's a great point, Jack. I think the issue about the Republican Party coming around on same-sex marriage is something that is complicated. We had Reince Priebus, the chairman of the Republican Party, come by National Review's office this past week, and he had an interesting observation of Portman. He said when it comes to someone like Portman who supports same-sex marriage, they're not going to be run out of the party. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the party is in any way ready to change its platform. And so I think you're seeing an openness to more ideas and perspectives on social issues, especially gay marriage. But when it comes to the platform committee, the rules committee, the RNC, this still remains a traditional marriage party. That's the core of the Republican Party. And if a lot of social conservatives are very cautious right now, very concerned that the Republican Party may be turning away from them. And they fear that if the Republican Party turns away from evangelicals and people who support traditional marriage, then maybe the party will gain some centrists and some independents, but it would lose its base.
Do you see it that way, Brian Monroe?
Well, you know, it's interesting. There is a struggle going on within the Republican Party, and it mirrors what's going on in the nation as a whole. You know, you have folks like Karl Rove and Portman. You know, we broke the Portman story, that have either through personal experiences or family experiences, or just you know, evolving their own opinions, see that there is a way that the Republican Party can embrace same-sex marriage without violating its core principles. And then, you know, you've got folks, for instance, on the libertarian wing that see, you know, any government interference in issues like this is not consistent with their views. So there's an interesting dance is happening. But the other piece of that, look at social media now. Look at what much of the rest of the country is doing. We had a poll on CNN that showed, you know, a growing majority of the country supports same-sex marriage. If you looked at Facebook this week and scrolled through, you know, some of your followers had the red logo with the equal sign for equal rights, and that caught on very quickly and was all over social media. So, you know, there is something is happening in this country, and whether it is peaking right now or just the beginning or just the tail end, and will that affect the judgment of the Supreme Court?
Here's some sound from Tuesday during oral arguments for California's ban on gay marriage, Prop 8. Here's Charles Cooper, the lawyer defending the ban, saying that redefining marriage to include same-sex couples could be harmful to the institution of marriage itself.
It is reasonable to be very concerned that redefining marriage as a genderless institution could well lead over time to harms to that institution and to the interests that society has always used that institution to address.
Bob Costa, Brian mentioned social media and the interest generally. How do you see societal interest impacting or being a consideration for the justices in this case?
I think it's going to be a consideration because when you talk to conservatives, I'm not speaking for the conservative justice here, but when you speak to conservatives generally, you see a much more tolerance across the country and in Republican and conservative circles for people who have different relationships, who have gay or lesbian partnerships. But when it comes to defining marriage, there's still a real reluctance among many conservatives to give up the idea that marriage is between a man and a woman. And so as much as gay rights are becoming a part of the conversation on the right, as much as they are on the left, marriage just doesn't factor into that as much as it does in the Democratic Party. And in some ways, this could be a way the Republican Party is missing the boat politically. But the people who make the argument for traditional marriage, they're not doing it necessarily because they have an aversion to certain lifestyles, but they really believe in the idea of a traditional marriage. And so that's where it gets complicated, because making that argument from a conservative perspective in this political climate, people are not really receptive to that, at least as they were maybe 5 or 10 years ago.
So, of course, these two cases are intricately connected. Prop 8 in California, the Defense of Marriage Act. Help us understand how they're intertwined. Could the court uphold Prop 8 to ban same-sex marriage, but rule that DOMA is indeed unconstitutional. Brian Monroe, what are the possibilities here?
That's possible. You know, again, a narrow ruling in Prop 8 that only affects California one way or the other is certainly likely. And Defense of Marriage Act, could be much broader. But even there, there's questions on standing. Did the parties have the proper legal standing to make the argument in the first place? So, there's a way out for the court. And there's also, if they want to take on the issues head on, they can do that, too.
Jack Beatty, do you see a way out for the court on these?
Well, there could be the Times, I think, caught a paradox in a headline the other day that success can prove to be a setback. And they meant that the seeming success, political success of the gay rights movement could be could hold up progress on the basic question of rights for everybody. And they cited the Chief Justice saying, as far as I can tell, he said to one of the lawyers, political figures are falling over themselves to endorse your side of the case. But that may be an illusion of proximity, at least according to the brief filed for the court by some political scientist that cites wholesale discrimination against gay Americans across the board.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about a week in the news, and you can join the conversation. What are your top stories this week? Will the president's plea on guns fall on deaf ears or be just the thing to reignite the debate? I'm joined this hour by Bob Costa of National Review, Brian Monroe of CNNPolitics.com, and On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Let's hear some sound from this week at the Supreme Court. They drew international attention as supporters and protesters of gay marriage gathered outside the court. Here's a woman interviewed by The Guardian. She says she believes children deserve a mom and a dad.
People can do what they want, but the people who choose to be gay and lesbian, they really don't have a right to tell us. We have to change what marriage means.
Advocates for gay marriage gathered outside the Supreme Court to voice their support. Here, a woman speaking to CBS explains why it's important for her to be there.
My objection to DOMA is that it means my marriage is not federally recognized. That means that the 1,138 rights that every married couple gets, male and female married couple gets, when they marry, are not given to same-sex couples.
And here's Edie Windsor, the widow challenging DOMA, speaking on the steps of the Supreme Court after the trial concluded on Wednesday. Here she is commenting on how she thought the trial went.
They were direct. They asked all the right questions. But I felt that, though I didn't feel any hostility, or any sense of inferiority, what do these people want? I mean, I felt we were all very respected, and I think it's going to be good.
Got a lot of listeners lined up on this. Let's go to the phones to Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Brad. Welcome to On Point.
I have a question about traditional marriage. Not that long ago, many states had laws, anti-miscegenation laws, that prevented white people and black people from getting married. Utah, for example, that great defender of marriage between one man and one woman, had a anti-miscegenation law that was on the books until 1976. And what if the federal government back then, or back in the 50s or 60s, had passed a law saying that it would not recognize a marriage between a black man and a white woman, or vice versa, in those states that did allow it. Anyway, I would just like to have your panel comment on the relationship of what's going on now with those old anti-miscegenation laws and traditional marriage.
That's interesting, Brad. Thank you. I mean, it does bring to mind how the court over time has really handled thorny social issues when it comes to trying to balance individual rights and social norms when things seem to be changing so quickly. Bob Costa, how do you see it?
It's a complicated issue for everyone involved, from the justices at the Supreme Court to those protesting outside and everyone watching these deliberations. And it's complicated because you really see the country changing in how it looks at same-sex relationships and same-sex marriage. But at the same time, there's just a tension because many people who are in traditional marriages between a man and a woman, they're not against same-sex partnerships, but they are very wary from a religious perspective, from a personal perspective, about the way government recognizes marriage, because they think there are marital norms that have been beneficial, and they are fiercely protective of those marital norms. But the way that this issue has become a civil rights issue is intriguing from a political perspective, because it's become more than just being a classroom discussion. Now it's about civil rights, not just about the definition. And I think that's what the court is also taking into consideration, that this means something much deeper than just a definition on a piece of paper to both camps.
Brian Monroe, what do you see here? I mean, what are we coming to understand about this court? Have they decided that in these times it needs to sort of pull back a little bit, let society sort out some of its culture wars before indeed it steps in?
Well, we will see that. When's the ruling due? As late as June? It could happen at any time. But as they come down on this, but it does signal an evolution in this country, and also it's one of the strengths of our democracy and the strengths of our political system that. We're not set in stone. We're not, hammered in concrete with our laws. They have to evolve. They have to grow as our culture grows and as society grows. The caller's right. African Americans couldn't marry whites within the last century until fairly recently. And, I think most people would understand now that that was wrong. But if we go back to, the founding fathers' philosophy, I couldn't vote. And that's the beauty of our system, that it can evolve.
Let's go to the phones. Amy is on the line from Greenfield, Massachusetts. Hi, Amy. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, folks. I just wanted to say that sometimes the glib part of me was going to come up with a bumper sticker that would say, well, I'm against gay marriage, but I don't know why. But then when I really think about it more thoughtfully, I realize that what's the main thing is to be really honoring and paying close attention to all views, and it's understandable that, religion and culture and personal things, as the caller from Tennessee just said, and I think that the more we can do that, the more successful, what will probably be an inevitable transition will be, and that even though, we are June brides, my partner and myself, and we immediately saved $7,000 on health insurance by my joining her plan at the time that I was a freelancer. And so, and that's important in it. And, yes, but it will come. I think that it is inevitable.
All right, Amy, thank you. Thank you very much. Here's Beth from Schenectady, New York. Hi, Beth. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hello.
Well, I'm going to tie all three together. I'm going to say that, I'm not opposed to gay marriage, but I think it's only going to help the upper middle class, and that is the point. Being homosexual was a mental illness until about, 1975, 76? And then the group organized, and now there's a lot of money behind it, as opposed to, say, the mentally ill, who Obama is ready to have their right to violate their civil rights. That is the poorest class. The mentally ill are the poorest class, and he's ready to with background checks. And by the way, they are not the most violent group. As a group, they tend to be not very violent. And now your last caller, and I congratulate her, mentions the tax breaks and health insurance. And one more time, I took a hit of $1,000 increase on my taxes this year, and I can't wait till Obamacare takes another $650. So I'm not a poet. Yeah,
Beth, thank you. I'm gonna let our panel get back in here. I do want to get some sound in because during hearings on this was Tuesday on California's Prop 8 on gay marriage, Samuel Alito, Justice Alito, cautioned against striking down that ban.
Same-sex marriage is very new. I think it was first adopted in the Netherlands in 2000. So there isn't a lot of data about its effect. And it may turn out to be a good thing. It may turn out not to be a good thing, as the supporters of Proposition 8 apparently believe. But you want us to step in and render a decision based on an assessment of the effects of this institution, which is newer than cell phones or the Internet? I mean, we are not... We do not have the ability to see the future.
Bob Costa, Supreme Court rarely gets ahead of the states on these issues. How do you see this? Concern that the case may have come too soon?
It's a very interesting part of the discussion, because you wonder how the justices are really looking at this. If this is a civil rights issue and it's about the ability of people to have a certain right, and it's almost a constitutional right, then you're going to see them rule, I think, in favor of same-sex marriage. But if it's about marital norms, it's about whether gay marriage is a good thing, and it's a judgment call on its effect and its role in society, and perhaps it's almost unknown historical data that people just don't know how this is all going to play out over the decades. If that's the factor, then they may rule against it. And so it really depends on how you see this. Is it a civil rights issue, or is it more about a cultural issue that the court has to mull in terms of how the government interprets something that happens broadly in society?
Jack Beatty, jump in here.
Well, you know, I think there's a view that, and we see it in the polls, that this is inevitable, that the march of progress or evolution of views will inevitably mean we will have same-sex marriage. But as I mentioned, there was a group of political scientists submitted an amicus brief for the court, really testing that idea and saying, look, this is a powerless political group. And they went through the indicia of powerlessness that are usually standard in Supreme Court jurisprudence. For example, gays are only 3.5% of the population. They're only 1% of state legislators, 1% of the U.S. Congress. No group, they point out, in American society has been targeted by ballot initiatives more than gays and lesbians. And part of the reason for that is that despite the polls showing that, a majority wants gay marriage, also a majority, according to a 2000 poll, 54% of Americans think that sex between two adults of the same sex was always, almost always, or sometimes wrong. In other words, coexisting with this sense that this is going to happen and we should have a gay marriage, is this, if you will, animus on the part of the majority of the public toward, if not gay rights, then gay intimacy. And that puts a severe limit, it seems to me, to what gay people can expect through the political branches. And that's the argument for the court stepping in. When people are politically powerless, that's when the court needs to say, no, we have to apply the standard of heightened scrutiny to any effort that would curb their rights. And you know, the fact that the gays are now almost all in, they've been captured by the Democratic Party. And you ask African Americans whether that's a good thing. I mean, African Americans can't go to the Republicans and say, the Democrats aren't doing much for us. What can you do? Well, neither now can gays. And that's not a good situation for a minority group.
An interesting. Go ahead, Brian.
I was going to jump in. The political angle is very real. Remember back in 2004, some say that George Bush may have not gotten a second term had it not been for the 13 state amendments or state ballot measures around same-sex marriage and making it either illegal or unconstitutional on a state level. And that brought out a lot of conservatives who may or may not otherwise have turned out in helping him get over the hurdle. But at the same time, you had the former mayor of San Francisco, Gavin Newsom, who's now lieutenant governor in California. He was the one that first on the city level in San Francisco made this an issue by allowing for that brief window gays to marry in California. And that, some say that was almost too early for this issue. And it set it on fire when the country wasn't ready. You may look back now and say maybe that was the spark that was needed to make this debate that's happening right now possible.
An interesting voice.
Politics has always been there.
Yes, an interesting voice. I just want to get this piece of sound in from one person this week that left a lot of people surprised was prominent conservative figure Bill O'Reilly of Fox News and the O'Reilly Factor, noting that the Supreme Court hearing on DOMA, talking about it and saying that the arguments have shifted, in his mind at least.
The compelling argument is on the side of homosexuals. Mm-hmm. That's where the compelling argument is. We're Americans. We just want to be treated like everybody else.
Bob Costa, I'll give you the last word on this before we move on.
I think Bill O'Reilly, who has been reviled by the American left for over a decade, he now is getting some acknowledgement because he is someone who's not only just a conservative, but he's a political observer, and he sees the political wind shifting. And I think his comments reflect exactly what Karl Rove and Rob Portman have been saying, that if the Republican Party really wants to reach out to independents and centrists, it doesn't necessarily mean they want to win the gay vote, but people who are more independent-minded on the left, who are independent-leaning, they consider how Republicans look at gay marriage as a very important litmus test for whether they will consider the GOP candidate. And so that's why you see conservatives being very cautious about how they approach this, because they don't want to lose not only those who support same-sex marriage, but the independents who are sympathetic towards that view.
All right. Much more to come on this. We'll follow it, of course. Let's move on for now and talk about gun control. President Obama pushed for new gun legislation this week. Brian Monroe, what do you think prompted him to reiterate his commitment to getting gun legislation passed?
Well, part of it was seeing that the issue was waning in public sentiment. You know, we're now months away from the Newtown shooting, and, you know, we had a poll that showed that the interest in new gun laws or stronger gun laws has been dropping and dropping pretty quickly from the peak right after that shooting. And so he looked at the numbers and said, hey, we got to get this fire started again if they want to have any progress. But at the same time, you've got now folks in Congress, Chuck Grassley, for instance, is looking at rewriting a bill that would dial back even what may be agreed upon right now with background checks and other issues, and watering that down. He's never been a supporter of assault weapons ban, and never been a supporter of large magazine limits. I think perhaps the president is feeling the ground shift and wants to do something about it.
Bob Costa, how do you view that public opinion shift? Enthusiasm for stricter gun control laws, it's waning so dramatically from 47% after the massacre at Newtown to 57% now.
It's all about how you define enthusiasm. I think after the tragedy in Connecticut, most Americans are appalled, and they'd like to see some kind of action. The question is, what does that action look like? And what's interesting to me is that even red state Democrats are very averse to the idea of having some kind of comprehensive gun control law, that you don't see much traction in the Senate for anything from both sides. Rather, what you see is some discussion about background checks. And even then, Republicans like Chuck Grassley, ranking member of the Judiciary Committee, he's running his own bill to run against the Democrats' bill to limit the kind of universal background checks. But you're not seeing assault weapon bans. You're not seeing any kind of meaty legislation that the gun control advocates want, because both parties, when they're behind the scenes, they say ahead of the 2014 elections, this is still very much a Second Amendment country, and that you can try to do some background checks, get rid of the gun show loophole, but good luck trying to get anything else, because it's just not politically viable at this point.
Jack Beatty, how seriously will Congress take this newest plea from the president, do you think?
Well, I hope they take it seriously, and they should take public opinion seriously. Yes, there's been this slippage of 10 points in the last month, I think, in a CBS poll of general support for the general idea of gun legislation. But look at the states now. There's some polls out from the states from the mayors against illegal guns. Arkansas, Mark Pryor, red state Democrat, 84% of people in Arkansas want mandatory background checks. Louisiana, Mary Landrieu, 85% of the people there do. Montana, another red state, Max Baucus, 79%. The point is, there's a great deal, almost universal support for background checks, and that is the crucial public safety element of this. We don't want guns going to criminals.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. In other news this week, a massive landslide in Washington State took out a huge 500-yard chunk of the hillside on Whidbey Island outside of Seattle. Homeowner Jim Cooper and his neighbors awoke to sounds they thought were an earthquake, only to find out that the hillside was missing.
You're missing 250 feet of lawn. And if you look down there, that's probably 200 feet down.
In March Madness, number one seed Indiana fell to Syracuse. Veteran basketball sportscaster Dick Vitale was excited about the victory.
It looked like Struggle City. Everybody was screaming, oh, wow, what's happening to Syracuse? What's happening? They're this close, baby, to go into the Final Four.
And former South African President Nelson Mandela spends a second night in the hospital with a lung infection. President Obama, while meeting with African leaders at the White House, sent his best wishes.
He's a hero, I think, to all of us. I'm sure that I speak for the other leaders here. We will be keeping him in our thoughts and prayers and his entire family.
I'm joined by Bob Costa of National Review, Brian Monroe of CNNPolitics.com, and On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Back to Washington for a moment. Here's President Obama attempting to increase pressure on Congress to pass gun control legislation.
Tears aren't enough. Expressions of sympathy aren't enough. Speeches aren't enough. We've cried enough. We've known enough heartbreak. What we're proposing is not radical. It's not taking away anybody's gun rights. It's something that if we are serious, we will do.
And then in a speech yesterday, President Obama questioned American attitudes toward gun control and the shootings in Newtown.
The notion that 2 months or 3 months after something as horrific as what happened in Newtown happens, and we've moved on to other things? That's not who we are. That's not who we are. Now, I want to make sure every American is listening today. Less than 100 days ago that happened. And the entire country was shocked. And the entire country pledged we would do something about it, and this time would be different. Shame on us if we've forgotten.
And then Kentucky Senator Rand Paul spoke on Fox News after that speech yesterday, asking Americans to remember the shootings in Newtown in a push to pressure Congress to pass gun control bills. Here's what Senator Rand had to say.
My question to the president is, call me if any of your reforms would have saved those kids at Sandy Hook. If anything he's proposing would have changed the outcome, I'll listen to him. I haven't heard one proposal from him or Harry Reid that would have saved one life. And I'm all for saving lives, and I think it's a real and horrible tragedy. But I think it's a mistake to play on these victims and the emotions of their tragedy when nothing he's proposing would change one iota of what happened.
Let's go to the phones on this issue. Chris is in Connecticut, Moosup, Connecticut. Chris, welcome. Thanks for waiting. You're on.
Thank you for taking my call, Jane.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a former member of the NRA. You must remember now, the people in control of the NRA are really whack jobs, mostly, and here's why. Rand Paul just said, show me what would have stopped it. If this law, what they are proposing now, had happened 10 years ago or hadn't been allowed to lapse, that person wouldn't have had that gun. If you can't shoot something and with clips that can fire 100, have 150 bullets, and it's ridiculous. If you can't hit what you're aiming for within five shots, you shouldn't be owning the gun. The only reason for this type of weapon and clips is to kill people.
All right, Chris, thank you. Brian Monroe, you hear Chris there. I mean, tell us about the president's goals for legislation, how they've changed since December.
Well, Chris's passions are felt around the country, but you know the interesting thing about this, as terrible and tragic as the Newtown shootings were, or Columbine, or many of the other mass shootings at schools or movie theaters in Aurora, most of the deaths that come by the hands of guns and gun users in America are not those mass shootings. They are domestic situations. One person knowing the other person and getting upset. And 16,000 shootings last year. You saw the tweet from Yoko Ono with the bloody glasses of John Lennon that there have been 1 million gun deaths in America since John Lennon was killed. That's really where the argument may need to shift. You know, while it was terrible what happened in Newtown, the deaths are happening on the streets of Chicago. They're happening in Miami. They're happening in Cleveland. They're happening in Seattle. They're happening in San Francisco. And in all those places, most of the time, the deaths are one person who knows another person who normally would have, you know, without a gun in the room or in the household or in the pocket or under the seat of the truck, would have, you know, expressed their anger in other ways. But because a gun was handy or in the back pocket walking down the street, that turned into a death right there on the spot. And I think, you know, the argument will probably shift from the spectacular to the, unfortunately, regular, routine, mundane killings of Americans in this country.
Here's another call from John in Greensburg, Kentucky. Hi, John. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. I'm against gun control laws because Chicago, they have the strongest gun control laws and some of the worst criminal activity. Criminals will still find a way to get guns. I'm a gun owner. I don't use my guns for the problem is in the heart of man. I don't use my guns to hurt anybody. I use them as a tool if I want to hunt, but I'm against gun control laws for anything.
All right, John. Thank you very much. I want to bring one more voice in here, New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg. He's entering the debate. He's got new ads that began running this week to encourage stricter gun control laws, especially universal background checks. Here he is.
My dad taught me to hunt, and I'll teach my kids. I've owned a gun all my life, and I'll fight for my right to keep it. Background checks have nothing to do with taking guns away from anyone. Closing loopholes will stop criminals and the dangerously mentally ill from buying guns. That protects my rights and my family.
Tell Congress, don't protect criminals. Vote to protect gun rights and our families with comprehensive background checks. Demand action now.
Bob Costa, button this up for us. What do you see happening? Where are we going from here?
I don't see much happening. I think that when you look at the Republican side, Senator Marco Rubio, Senator Rand Paul, Mike Lee, Ted Cruz, they've all pledged to filibuster the Democrats' gun control bill. And I don't think Mayor Bloomberg from New York with his $12 million ad campaign is going to apply the kind of political pressure that forces this thing to come through. The real pressure to me is the pressure from the conservative Democrats in red states who are going to ask these senators like Joe Manchin and Claire McCaskill, are you really going to go against gun owners who are against these background checks? So that's the political pressure, not from Bloomberg.
Jack, yes, I was going to say, but as I pointed out, in these states, 85% in Arkansas want background checks. We're down to the cadre.
Yeah, but the kind of background checks matter. I mean, that's the whole point of the Grassley bill that's coming out of the Republican Senate Judiciary Committee because they don't like the universal nature of how the Democrats are approaching it.
Well, they want to close the gun show loophole, right? And isn't that where, 40% of guns come out of that? That seems to be implicit in these questions. How much courage does it take for a senator to say no when he's got 91% of the public on his side? Does that really take all that much courage? The NRA's batting average in the last election was miserable. And, of course, their ads are not notably truthful. I mean, they run these just deeply mendacious ads that'll, I'm sure, make it seem like they're coming to take your gun. But people have to stand up to that and simply consult their common sense. I mean, John calls and says, I don't want gun control, but nothing that anybody is proposing would bother his, would interfere with his liberty. It's a matter of making us all safe from dangerous people.
Bob, your last word.
It's about technicalities as well. I mean, when you read Roll Call and Politico this week, you hear about Tom Coburn, conservative from Oklahoma, working with Joe Manchin, moderate Democrat from West Virginia, to try to hammer out the details of what the federal government's real role is in background checks. And I respect your point, Jack, about how it seems like the country is moving towards more gun control, and that seems like it's a politically easy decision to make. But for a lot of these gun owners, it's the nitty gritty, where you dot the I, that matters on this federal legislation. The extent of the federal overreach over guns is something that's very important to gun owners. That I think is going to be a snag for the Democrats' bill and why you're going to probably see a compromise bill.
All right.
Bob talks about it at a federal level, which is where a lot of the action is. But quietly, you need to look at the state level. That's where the changes are happening. You got Colorado this week looking at sweeping legislation on gun control. What Mayor Bloomberg is doing, remember, he has got some very deep pockets. And his coalition of mayors that have been launching these ads and rallies, they're targeting Maryland, they're targeting Colorado, they're targeting New York, they're targeting several states. And, ironically, while it may be stalled on the federal level, there's quite a bit of activity that's happening state by state.
All right, let's move quickly since the clock is against us. Let's go from gun control to the budget fight in Washington. And House Speaker John Boehner this week hailing success against President Obama in a memo he issued to Republicans. Boehner said the House GOP's new tactical plan to fight Obama and Democrats on spending has been largely successful, and asked his rank and file, where do you want to go from here, essentially? So has the balance shifted on this issue? Do you see it, Jack?
Well, you know, is it a success that that the Republicans have essentially agreed to, well, put a block on almost anything the president wants to do on the budget? Is that a success? It's a success for Republican cadres. It's a success for the Republican base. But does it help with the problem that the GOP identified in their postmortem, namely that the public sees it as an obstructionist party? And what Mr. Boehner is saying is, we did a great job where we obstructed him here. We're going to obstruct him there. We're not going to give way. We got the sequester. But it, you know, and that all makes the GOP base happy. But that's not where the next national election is going to be fought. Those votes are all going to go to the GOP. They've got to worry about how do we make the tent bigger again. And it's a fair question whether obstruction and saying obstruction is great is the way to do that.
Brian Moore, do the prospects of a grand bargain with the president appear dim at this point?
I think they've always appeared dim, unfortunately. You know, I've talked to several folks here in D.C., and one of the questions out there is whether, you know, we saw it reflected in the Boehner memo or pervasively, whether the efforts of the Republican Party to marginalize the president and his agenda have really worked. You have to hand it to them. They've been very successful. And, you know, look at how many CRs have we had, continuing resolutions rather than full budgets? Part of that is because the president hasn't put up his own budget until now. He said he's going to put one up on April 10th. But, you know, if you wanted a tactic to limit the far-reaching impact of a president, even in the second term, you try as hard as you can not to have anything stick. And through short-term plans or stopping legislation, that's an effective tactic to make sure there's little left to a legacy that right now has Obamacare and other things to show for it.
Bob Costa?
I think the challenge for Republicans in 2013 is, can they really, in divided government, find a way to work with the president on entitlement reform? It's the core part of the Republican message, but they're not going to be able to do that really without coming to grips with some revenue on tax reform. Not necessarily tax rate increases, but revenue regarding tax reform. And Boehner is very confident in how he's won these small skirmishes, the CR, how he's dealt with the sequester. And Republicans are feeling confident, but on the big things they want to change on the fiscal front, they still have a lot of work to do.
In our last couple of minutes here, let's get in North Dakota, because on Tuesday, the nation's most restrictive abortion regulations were signed into law there. Republican State Representative Bette Grandy, representing Fargo, said this not only sends a statement to the people of North Dakota, but to the world.
We are showing the citizens of the nation, and according to some of my emails, the world, that North Dakota believes in the life of the unborn child, believes that the heartbeat is life.
Bob Costa, what do you see this law? Where do you see it going? Do you see it being overturned? Do you see it being upheld? Do you see it being challenged to Roe v. Wade?
It's definitely going to remain a contentious issue. And it just reaffirms to me that there are many pockets in this country where they're looking at the social debate and they're frustrated and they're angry. They are frustrated that traditional marriage is eroding. They're frustrated that the culture is becoming, in many ways, pro-choice. And you're going to see a lot of conservative state legislatures, like what's happening up in North Dakota, continue to react with this kind of legislation, trying to push for the more traditional conservative view.
How do you see it, Brian?
Well, you know, this is definitely a full head-on attack against Roe v. Wade. And, you know, the only thing I think everyone will agree on is that this is a full employment act for lawyers. They're going to be busy for quite a while litigating this at the state level and at the federal level. And there will be no easy resolution for quite a while.
How long might it take, Jack, for this to go through the court system?
Well, there's probably going to be a stay on it from state or federal courts early, and then it'll get to the Supreme Court. You know, what I'm struck with is the reaction of the more mainstream right-to-life groups against this. James Bopp, for example, general counsel of the National Right to Life, he says if any one of these measures, meaning the one and similar one in ARCS, ever got to the Supreme Court, it's highly unlikely that they're so obviously unconstitutional, it would actually allow the court to refashion abortion law altogether under gender discrimination, which would mean that all regulations would be unconstitutional. He said, I don't know what these people are thinking. Normal people don't spend a lot of time banging their heads against the wall. And that's what this is constitutionally. 6 weeks is the viability period here. Under Roe, it's 24 weeks. So it's directly in conflict with Roe. And it's another case of, you know, Christy Todd Whitman, the former Republican governor of New Jersey, says, you know, our problem isn't with the messaging, and that's what seemed to be what the postmortem said a few weeks ago. The problem is with the message. And here the message is, we want to take away abortion rights.
Well, thank you very much to our panel today. Really important insights. Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst. Thank you very much, Jack.
Thank you.
Robert Costa, Washington editor for National Review. Bob, always nice to have you. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Brian Monroe, editor of CNNPolitics.com. Brian, thanks so much.
Always a pleasure.
You can continue the conversation, listeners, and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.